Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I'm chatting with you today from one of my favorite cities in the world, Austin, Texas. What a wonderful oasis of progressive thought in a red state. I'm still out on my Miss America book tour, and I recently stopped in Dallas, where along with some book events, I joined the Dallas Peace Community in a little housewarming visit to ex-president, but current scoundrel, George Bush's new Dallas home, and we were demanding accountability. So we marched about a mile from the corner of Preston and Royal. We marched to where the checkpoint is before you go into George Bush's neighborhood. There was about 100 of us, and we were calling for a special prosecutor for George Bush and Dick Cheney, and also telling him that not everybody in Dallas is welcoming him. So it was a great protest. I got a lot of static from the left and the right about it. Well, you know, the right always attacks me, and the left is upset because we're protesting Bush for the same things that Obama's currently doing. So I'm going to give you at the end of the show an email I got from somebody who supported our action and an email I got from someone who did not support our action. And I'm also very excited to announce that soon our soapbox will be broadcast on the air from the radio from KMNY AM 1360 Rational Radio in Dallas, Texas. And that's a place where our voice and our vision really needs to be heard. So I'm very excited about that. Last week, we talked to Black Panther Party member Richard Brown. Remember, we chatted with Richard about the San Francisco 8 case. This week, it was supposed to start on the 6th, and it's been postponed again until July 6th. That was for the pretrials. They have postponed it again. You know, I really think the man is sticking around with these people to keep them distracted, to keep them spending their money and their time in something that is totally irresponsible and reckless, this prosecution of the San Francisco 8. So today on the Soapbox, we'll be talking about another travesty of injustice that happened here in Texas. After the break, I'll be speaking to Khalil Meek, who will be talking about the case of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. You're listening to us at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Soon you'll be listening to us, Rational Radio in Dallas, Texas. Stay tuned.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
This is Jamie Romano of James Communications. We are living in such exciting times. Never before in history has the global community come together in solidarity as we are now. Wonderful work is being done locally, nationally, and globally on every human and environmental issue that needs to be addressed. I developed James Communications to help you maximize your contribution to the world. Whether you're a small group, a large organization, or an individual with an altruistic dream, if you're working in service to humanity or the planet, James Communications will work with you to streamline efficiency and strengthen the impact of your cause or campaign. For more information on how James Communications can help you do what you do, please visit www.jamescommunications.com.
Don't forget, you can always contact me at Cindy@CindySheehan.com. My guest today is Khalil Meek, president of the Muslim Legal Fund of America. Khalil, welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
Good afternoon, Cindy. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I think what you're doing is very important, and I think the country needs to know what's happening there in Dallas. You're the president of the Muslim Legal Fund of America?
Yes, that's correct.
What does the MLFA do, and what do you do there in Dallas?
The Muslim Legal Fund is a charitable organization that collects funds to defend civil rights of Muslims in America. So our goal is to provide legal counsel wherever it may be needed so that people get due process and a fair trial.
And so the reason that I became aware of you, of course, is because of the Holy Land Foundation 5 case there in Dallas. And you all are a very strong part of that, aren't you?
Yes, we are. We actually supported the defense for the defendant.
Well, I want you to tell my listeners, you have a very long time to talk about it. Tell my listeners about the case. What happened, why the foundation got in trouble. And it's been a very long legal struggle, but I want you to start from the beginning, please.
Well, the case actually, begins shortly after 2001. In December of 2001, President Bush said that he had reason to believe, or this was his opinion, that the Holy Land Foundation was the largest source of funding for Hamas in America. And in December of 2001, he shut down the largest Muslim charitable organization in America through an executive order. Without any grand jury or judicial process, he based his decision and made an executive order. After shutting the charity down in December of 2001, and they had an office in Dallas, Texas, but they also had offices in Chicago and California and New Jersey. The Department of Justice and Homeland Security and all the agencies went through the documents of the Holy Land Foundation and all their records and all of the information that was available to them. And in 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, the government couldn't find one transaction to support their conclusion or the executive order that the Holy Land had provided any material support for Hamas whatsoever.
Right.
And so in 2004, they changed their theory. And they said, what we think is happening now is that the Holy Land was sending funds to what are called zakat committees or charities or what would you call 501c3s over in Palestine. And that these charitable organizations in Palestine would receive the funds from the Holy Land, and the Holy Land would earmark the funds for either food, clothing, shelter, education, or medical supplies for the Palestinian people, and that these charitable organizations, these zakat committees, would deliver the aid upon request. So the government says, yes, we've tracked the money, that the money was sent to these charitable organizations. These charitable organizations actually delivered the aid to the Palestinians in the form of humanitarian aid, all of it. Nothing was missing. But the government said that what they believed to be true is that the charitable organizations in Palestine were under the influence of or operating on behalf of the organization of Hamas, and that because this was the government's conclusion, that their war on terror would include this transaction as material support. The government said that even though these charitable organizations delivered the aid itself had the effect of winning the hearts and minds of the Palestinians. And the government claimed that the affection that they received was given to the organization of Hamas through humanitarian aid. This was the legal battle that took place in a courtroom twice in Dallas.
Can I ask you a break really quick there and ask you a question?
What did the
Holy Land Foundation sending money to Palestine, why did that have anything to do with America? Did Israel ever prosecute the Holy Land Foundation or any of the charities that received Holy Land Foundation money?
Well, actually, that's a good point. No, the United States Treasury Department and the United States State Department have a list of what they call designated organizations or designated individuals who no U.S. Citizen or business can do any transactions with. And on that list that the U.S. Keeps, none of the charities listed in Palestine were ever put on the list. Never were they designated as anything. They're licensed by either the Palestinian authorities or Israel or Jordan over the years. These are the oldest, most well-established charitable organizations in Palestine. And the United States government was actually sending aid to the same charitable organizations during the same time period to the same Palestinian people as the time period that the Holy Land was supposedly winning the hearts and minds by doing the exact same transaction to these charitable organizations.
What other charitable organizations were sending money to these same organizations in Palestine?
Well, we know that USAID was sending funds to the Zakat committees, and the UN was sending money to the same Zakat committees. And there's a couple others, but I don't remember the names offhand. But they were mentioned in the trial as organizations who were providing humanitarian aid in the exact same fashion as the Holy Land, yet with no consequence or any argument as to their intentions, I guess, or the outcome of it.
So it seems obvious that the Holy Land Foundation was targeted because of the Muslim aspect then.
Well, we feel like it was more of a persecution than a prosecution because the argument of feeding children is a crime has got so many flaws in it that humanitarians are, believe it has a chilling effect. This case is not about any violence or harm or the Holy Land funding what anybody would consider a terrorist act. It's the argument that any benefit to a terrorist organization, and they're saying that these Zakat committees are under the control or under the influence, is just a persuasive argument because nobody, no U.S. personnel testified at trial as this being the case. The only person that could tell the court that the conclusion of the government was true was an unidentified Israeli officer who was ordered to testify in a U.S. courtroom as an expert witness as an alias, an anonymous. Well, we don't really know who he was. But he came over and told the jury that it was a well-known fact that all of these Zakat committees were under the control of Hamas and that the effect of providing humanitarian aid through the Zakat committees was winning the hearts and minds of Palestinians for the benefit of that organization. And this is the only crime alleged in the entire prosecution's argument.
Well, you told us that George Bush signed an executive order shutting down the Holy Land Foundation. You told us that the Justice Department investigated, found no wrongdoing, but then charges were brought against the Holy Land Foundation, weren't they?
The criminal charges were brought against five individuals who were associated with the Holy Land Foundation. Some of them were the board of directors, one was the executive director, one was the one that ran an office in New Jersey, and one was a non-employee that had just participated in fundraising events.
And what were the charges?
The charges were accusing the defendants of providing material support to the organization of Hamas, or actually they called it a conspiracy to provide material support. And each transaction that the defendant sent to the Zakat committees in Palestine became a separate indictment. So the argument was it was a conspiracy to fund Hamas, and they did so by sending it to the Zakat committees, the charities. The charities provided the aid. The Palestinians' hearts and minds were won, and the government argued that that affection was given to Hamas, not the Holy Land, which is a U.S. charity that was giving money all over the world, the United States, Chechnya, Bosnia, Palestine, everywhere. But government claimed that this humanitarian aid was provided in a manner that benefited a terrorist organization, and that was the crime.
So there was one trial that ended in a mistrial. When was the first trial?
Yeah, the first trial took place in June of 2007. And there were actually over 200 indictments or charges to the five individuals in the organization. And they were all basically the same, about 30-something counts each. And it just said the same thing over and again, this transaction, one indictment, this transaction. So you had multiple indictments for the same thing. I mean, the Holy Land was an open book charity. They reported their transactions to the IRS every year they filed a tax return. They told them we were sending money to this charitable organization. This organization provided this relief, and we have proof that the relief was delivered. And so they filed their tax returns as an open book, saying we did this. And after the fact, the government says, well, you said that you provided humanitarian aid to the Palestinians, and we don't consider material support to be humanitarian aid, so you lied on all your tax returns. So they added tax charges because of the claim that the government made that these were transaction of material support, not humanitarian aid. And in the first trial, over 200 counts, the trial took place for 2 or 3 months here in Dallas. The jury listened to all of the.
When was the first trial?
Yes, this is the first trial.
And what date was that? What month and year?
July of 2007, I believe, is when it started, and it ended around September or November of October of 2007.
Okay, and you were saying that the jury listened to the evidence and go ahead. And
yeah, the prosecution basically got up there, and to make their case, they said, look, we want to show you a bunch of evidence that we see from the Holy Land Foundation. And they proceeded to show the Holy Land Foundation doing fundraising events all over the United States. They showed them, inviting people to a dinner or a fundraising dinner at a banquet hall or some hotel. And hundreds of people would show up, and they would get on stage, and they would talk about, and this was in the late 80s, like 87, 88, 89, 90, and they would get up there, and it was shortly after the Intifada in Palestine when the Palestinian issue was gaining international attention. So the Holy Land said, look, let's talk about the Palestinian people, talk about the problems over there, let's raise money and send it as humanitarian relief. And they would get on stage and act out all of the social skits or all of the frustrations that the Palestinians have had over the years with the Israeli occupation. They would sing the songs, they would do skits, they would... just everything that had to do with the frustrations of the Palestinian community, and then people would emotionally respond and donate to the cause. Well,
right.
In these skits or in these plays, Hamas was a new organization that was against the occupation, and
right.
As a new organization or a political party, people were hoping that they were going to make a difference. So the people in the Holy Land would say, okay, you know, they would say something nice about Hamas or hopefully that they would liberate the Palestinians. Well, in 88, 89, 90, Hamas was just a political movement. But later, in, I don't know the exact date, 94, 95, they became a designated terrorist organization. Well, the Holy Land never associated with them. They never continued to do any of their skits after 94, 5, whatever that time period. But the government says that because of these freedom of speech type plays and skits, it showed the mindset, it showed the attitude of the Palestinians towards Hamas, or these individuals towards Hamas, and they said that after 2000 or after 94, 95, there were no other evidence introduced in the courtroom whatsoever to support a conspiracy. But in 2001, they shut the organization down, and in 2002, Israel, under an Operation Defensive Shield, raided all of the charitable organizations in Palestine, seized a bunch of evidence, and then proceeded to take from that what they thought was relevant and provided to the United States attorneys to say, use this information to support the conclusion that these attack committees are under the influence of Hamas, because we find posters of Hamas officials, or we find these kids singing the same songs that you see them doing back in 88 and 89 and 90. And so all of this circumstantial stuff was presented to the jury, and the government said, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, it must be a duck. And they showed the relationships that these individuals had with some of their family members were actually in the organization of Hamas. They showed other individuals not related to this event as coming over and doing public speaking at some of the events, that said politically they were associated or as a political party they supported Hamas. So people that, it's just all this, all these things that the government kind of painted a picture that look at this conspiracy, look at these intentions of these individuals. Well, the defense got up and said, straight up, Your Honor, the Holy Land is an open book charity. It based its humanitarian aid on need, not creed or politics. And it presented to say that it followed every law that is in force today. In fact, went be above and beyond to make sure that they tried to follow the law. And they showed the jury that, look, there's a list that the government keeps of designated organizations, and none of these charities are listed on either one of the lists. The United States government has sent the money at the same time period. The Holy Land sent John Bryant as a representative to all the intelligence community in D.C., the State Department, the FBI, and I can't remember who else, to say, is there anything that we can do as a charity to make sure that we're following all the guidelines, there's an open book, and any recommendations you have for us? And then in court, the defense called as a witness Edward Abington. And Edward Abington was the consul general to the United States during the time period of this indictment. He was a 30-year senior officer with the State Department. He was based in Jerusalem. And during this time period, he was the eyes and ears of the United States intelligence and voice in that region. And he said he was under direct orders not to meet with or establish relations with anyone known to be party to Hamas. So the U.S. does not negotiate with terrorist organizations. And he received information on a daily basis from the FBI, the State Department, the CIA, even the Israeli Mossad. And he said, I never was informed during this time period that any of these committees were under the control of or operating on behalf of Hamas, and I personally met with each and every one of them. So after the defense had presented its case and the prosecution presented its case, the jury came back and on 208 counts came back with zero guilty verdicts. The majority of the verdicts were either in the favor of the defendant, some like 100 of the counts were like total acquittals, like 12-0 for acquittal. And then the other half were a mixed count, like 11-1, 10-2, you know, for acquittal. But there were no guilty verdicts in the entire process.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, but I want to talk about there was a retrial, and they must have been on the charges that there was a mistrial of, because in this country we still have something called double jeopardy. We're talking to Khalil Meek about the case of the Holy Land Foundation 5. We'll be right back with Cindy Sheehan Soapbox after this break.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. We're talking to Khalil Meek from the Muslim Legal Fund of America about the Holy Land Foundation 5 case that just concluded in Dallas, Texas. Well, in the first trial, like you said, most of the charges or many of the charges they were acquitted of. Some they had a mistrial. So apparently the government reintroduced the new charges in a new trial. And tell us what happened during that trial.
Exactly. What actually, I want to comment on just one thing further that happened in the first trial that's what we think is incredibly relevant. And that is when the jury, after deliberating for over a month or on these charges, They came back and they signed their verdict on a Thursday afternoon. And normally when the verdict is signed, within an hour or so, you go into the courtroom, you read the verdict, and everybody goes home.
Right.
But in the first trial, what had happened is the verdict was signed on Thursday afternoon. The judge was not present. He had ordered or left two or three other judges in charge in his absence who were not to be found. So what happened is they sealed the verdict on a Thursday and held it over until a Monday morning to read the verdict out loud in the courtroom.
Uh-huh.
So on Monday when they read it, the charges, like I said, half of them were full acquittals and the other half were a hung or mixed decision. And in a federal prosecution case, it takes 12-0 for the jurors, a unanimous for guilty, and it takes unanimous for acquittal. And
right.
any mix is called a tie. So if it's 11-1, 10-2, or 6-6, it's considered a tie or a mistrial. And after they read the verdicts, the government has the right, and so does the defense, to poll the jurors in open court and just ask them, is this your verdict, in case they were under pressure or something. They
right.
give them an opportunity to speak their mind one last time to agree with their own verdict.
Right.
And in open court on Monday morning, one of the jurors changed their mind on all the charges that she had voted for acquittal on, except for one defendant. And it made about 60 or so of the charges that were full acquittal to go back and be a hung jury again.
Wow.
And the government said, we are going to retry every count that is a mistrial that was tied in a second trial. I mean, they didn't even leave the courtroom before they said they're going to do it again.
Wow.
And
do you think some kind of pressure was exerted on her over the weekend?
Well, I'm not sure how to read it, but it's very awkward that somebody signs their name to something, they agree to it, and normally you go out and after you've been deliberating for a month, I'm sure there's a consensus that builds over time and pressure and
right.
everybody comes to an agreement. And then
right.
when you have Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and almost a week to unwind and come back and look at the jury again, then obviously she had changed her decision. For whatever reason.
Wow. Wow.
But the important part of this that I really want to share with the audience is the fact that while the jury was deliberating, a question was sent to the judge that got everybody's attention. In a courtroom, and I don't mean to make this too technical, but you try to get evidence in and you fight to see what the jury's allowed to see. And after
right.
you get documents in as evidence, then you're allowed to tell a story to the jury as to what that evidence means. And
right.
you can use illustrations and demonstratives and whatever you think. You can make it as persuasive as you know how to be to persuade the jury that your conclusion of these facts is true. And these are called demonstrative exhibits. And yet,
uh-huh.
whenever the trial is over and the jury has to go back to the jury room, only the evidence goes with the jury, and all the demonstratives or all these exhibits are thrown in the trash because the jury's turn now is to look at the evidence and make up their own conclusion as to what happened, because they hear from the defense their demonstration, and they hear from the prosecution their opinion, and it's their turn to decide. But
right.
none of these demonstrations go as evidence to the jury room. It's over with. They hear it in the court, and then it's finished.
Uh-huh.
Well, during the deliberations, the jurors sent a question to the judge in the first trial and said, Judge, did any of the demonstratives make it to the jury room? We're confused. We think we may have some demonstrative exhibits back here to be considered as evidence. So the judge calls the prosecution and the defense attorneys to the court and says, did you send any of your exhibits and materials to the jury room? Defense says no. Prosecution says no. And basically it's propaganda. I mean, it's your opinion of what the facts mean. So the judge
right.
orders the jury to consider all the evidence in the jury room as a fact and weigh it as evidence. And then we see the verdict that we got. So moving forward, because that question was asked, our lawyers were curious, and so they, I don't know if it's subpoenaed or what the technical term is, but they requested to see the evidence that the jury was talking about. And when they got back to the evidence, they found that even though the prosecution told the judge none of their exhibits had made it to the jury room, over 200 and something pages of demonstrative exhibits had made it from the prosecution to the jury room. And the jury was using that, or was ordered to consider that as evidence. So they're sitting there looking at the propaganda of the government, the conclusions of the government, and having to persuade each other based on that type of evidence whether this is true or not. And we're told that some of the jurors that were for conviction were using the demonstratives as the heart of their argument, meaning this is what this document says, therefore they have to be guilty.
Right.
And when we found that out, this is gross misconduct on the prosecution's part. And we argue that, you know, now that the government wants a retrial and we're listening to the jurors say that the ones voting for conviction were relying on the demonstrative exhibits, this is a gross injustice because the government's actually causing the mistrial, which may have ended or should have ended in a total acquittal, and they're going to benefit from it for a second trial. So it should fall under double jeopardy. We wrote that motion, and we're waiting for the appellate court to decide on it. But in that interim, the judge said, well, we can go ahead with a second trial. So while that's still sitting on the shelf and unfinished, a year later, they start a second trial, and the government comes back, and they charge the defendants, I think now it was about 100 counts in the second trial, and basically all of them is a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy case that the government doesn't have any smoking guns. They don't have any evidence of actual direct support. It's just the idea of these Zakat committees convincing a jury that they are benefiting Hamas. And so in the second trial, we find that the government has a huge advantage over the first trial in that it knows everything that the defense is going to say about what it, what it did to follow the law. And so they start off in their opening statements in the second trial, and they tell the jury, you're going to hear a lot of information about the law, but we're here to tell you that when they talk about the Treasury list or the State Department list or these designated lists that we keep, you can't rely on them. They're not reliable, that they're not complete. They're really just a good suggestion, but they're in no way to be relied upon as fact because it's just too hard or too difficult for us to keep it accurate, even though there's hundreds and hundreds of organizations on there, and they had years and years and years to list these organizations as designated organizations. Even until today, they haven't listed them as a designated organization. The government said, don't rely on them. And then they brought in the State Department to tell you how bad the list is. They brought in the Treasury Department to tell you how bad the list is. Then they brought in the IRS to tell you that in, 2006, you know, after the fact, this case was before 2001, we changed the statute that says you can't rely on these lists or don't rely on them or use your best judgment. So they kind of erased that part of the law that you can't follow it. They said that Edward Abington, when he testified for the defense the second time, before he got to go in front of the jury, they muted his credentials or his ability to say where he received his intelligence from, calling it national security, that he couldn't tell him he received daily information from the CIA, the State Department, Mossad, and what he thought about it. He could only say that he was the State Department official and what his opinion was. And so they somewhat muted the defense. They told him that there is no law for to follow, and they convinced the jury that if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, it must be a duck. And they told the jury, you figure it out.
Yeah, tell us about the so-called secret witness that is fundamentally and profoundly unconstitutional.
Well, we have a lot of issues that took place in the courtroom that we think are serious concerns for the appellate courts. What we've had happen in this trial is that for the first time in U.S. history, the court allowed what's called an unidentified or an anonymous expert witness.
Hold on a second, Khalil. I want to make something clear that these five gentlemen who are being tried are American citizens, right?
Correct.
It shouldn't matter if they weren't, but they are American citizens. So go ahead.
They're all American citizens. They all have many children that are American citizens. They lived here for 20, 30 years. They have done everything they can to promote America and humanitarian aid and be good citizens.
And then, like you said, what happened for the very first time in American history during this trial?
The first time that's ever take place is to let someone testify as an expert witness without knowing who the expert is. The only thing the court was allowed is to say that somebody could come over here and they could give you their opinion, and based on that opinion, you can argue it in the courtroom what they're saying, but not who they are. You couldn't perjure them. You couldn't show a bias. You couldn't show a history. You don't even know who the expert is other than they're in the courtroom to talk about their expertise. but there's no way to challenge that expertise and to vet it or to expose it for what it might be, because you don't even know who the defendant is. It's Avi was the name of this witness, and he was the only person that could come to a U.S. courtroom and testify as to whether or not these Akkad committees were under the control of or operating on behalf of Hamas. There was not one U.S. official, intelligence person, or anybody working for the U.S. government that could render that opinion, other than a gentleman that was ordered by the Israeli military to testify as an expert and anonymously. We think that's a serious issue that needs to be addressed.
That's an understatement, saying that's a serious issue. That not only goes against our Constitution, that goes against, like, centuries-old, you know, due process things about being able to face your accuser. How in the name of anything was that allowed in an American court of law?
Well, it goes along with the whole idea of the government's case, because adding to that, the fact that Israel went and did a military operation and raided the Zakat committee without any witnesses, without any cameras, without any evidence. They just seized, or they actually gathered information, took it back somewhere, sorted through it, and then told the U.S., come and see what we have. And then whatever they presented to the U.S., they said, use this as evidence to support our conclusion that these Zakat committees are operating on behalf of Hamas. But they did not allow they had no details on where these, you know, they couldn't tell you if anything was found in the trash, on the wall, in the garbage, who found it, at what time. There's undocumented, just, here, trust us, we found this stuff here, use it. And then when the defense said, okay, let us see everything that you took from those Akkad committees, let us see all of it so that we can see what would benefit the defense and make an argument with it. And they were denied the opportunity to see anything other than what Israel allowed the government to use for the prosecution.
Wow.
So you have no chain, there's no chain of custody, there's no protection of evidence, there's no witnesses, there's no filming, and there's no time date stamp to any of that. It's just, here, we found this, or we have this, trust us, use it.
And this is incredible. We're running out of time. We only have about 5 more minutes, but what I'd like to talk about, because in this trial the outcome was different. Every defendant it was guilty on all charges, right? And each defendant got 65 years in prison, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, the defendant got from 15 to 65 years. But let me make a statement that this trial is an all or nothing, because of all the charges in the indictment for all 5 men boiled down to one issue. In other words, either you're going to be, you should be innocent on all charges, or you should be guilty of all charges.
And
the reason is because if it is a conspiracy to provide material support to these Zakat committees that are operating on behalf of Hamas, then you're obviously guilty on everything, or you're innocent, because that's the only thing that matters in the courtroom.
Right.
If you were innocent on one, it would be hard to be guilty on another. Or if you're guilty on one, it'd be impossible to be innocent on the other.
Right. So they were convicted, and like I told my listeners in my introduction, this is one of the most fundamental miscarriages of justice in the history of American jurisprudence. And, you know, an injustice to one is an injustice to all. We need to stand up and fight for these people, and there will be an appeal, and the lead attorney on the appeal is somebody who... it is very relevant to what's going on. Can you tell us about the appeal and who's the lead attorney?
The appeal will have each defending having an attorney, but the lead attorney that will present the appeal is a gentleman named John Klein. If you don't know who John Klein is, he is a gentleman who had defended Oliver North in his hearings. Wen-Ho Lee in Arizona was accused of being a spy or some kind of espionage, and he was able to get a full acquittal and an apology from the government. Also defended a gentleman named Scooter Libby. So he will be leading the defense in its arguments when the appellate issues.
Well, I hope they're is some sanity in the appeal, because this clearly is un-American, what is happening to the Holy Land Foundation. I was looking at some, and I want my listeners to go to your website. Can you tell my listeners your website? And I'm going to urge everybody to donate whatever we can for their legal defense fund.
We would appreciate that. Yes, you can visit our website at www.mlfausa.org. Muslim Legal Fund of America, mlfausa.org. And you will see the case of the Holy Land Foundation, and just follow the links, and you can donate, get as much information as you need, or send us an email for further comments or whatever you'd like.
Well, Khalil, I know you're not part of the Holy Land Foundation, but I was reading, you know, some commentary on the case, and one comment said that the Holy Land Foundation, it was in their charter to obliterate Jews. Is that the truth?
No, that's not true. Nothing that the defendants ever said. Let me just read a quote from one of the lead attorneys, a lady named Nancy Hollander. She said it's remarkable. She said, my client was convicted of providing charity. There was not in 10 years of wiretapping his home, his office, his faxes, listening to everything that he said, there was not one word out of his mouth about violence to anyone or about support for Hamas. He provided charity, and that's what he was convicted of. In this case, the Holy Land, it was nothing but a charitable organization that provided humanitarian aid where it was most needed. But the government made the argument that the Hamas, in their charter and their constitution, they called the destruction of Israel. So the government's argument is that the Holy Land is just operating on behalf of Hamas, therefore it agrees with all of whatever Hamas does or says.
Okay, well, Khalil, I think we're running out of time. I really thank you for coming on my show today and sharing this case with my listeners. Like I said, I urge everybody to go and donate whatever you can to help with these gentlemen's legal defense fund. I believe that they're political prisoners. You know, I believe that the only reason they're in prison is because the climate of fear and racism and, you know, persecution generated against all Muslims in, you know, George Bush's war of terror against the world. And we just, like I said before, when their rights get taken away, our rights get taken away too. And we just have to extend the same human rights to everybody, not just a certain segment of our society. So thank you for struggling so hard for this case and for people's legal rights. I really appreciate it.
Well, we thank you, Cindy, and keep up the good work, and let us know how we can help.
You too, and hopefully we can have you on soon, and we'll be able to report some good news about the appeal. Thank you, Khalil.
Thank you.
You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. This is Cindy Sheehan. We've been talking to Khalil Meek, who's in Dallas. I'm in Austin. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with my rant.
This is Jamie Romano of James Communications. We are living in such exciting times. Never before in history has the global community come together in solidarity as we are now. Wonderful work is being done locally, nationally, and globally on every human and environmental issue that needs to be addressed. I developed James Communications to help you maximize your contribution to the world. Whether you're a small group, a large organization, or an individual with an altruistic dream, if you're working in service to humanity or the planet, James Communications will work with you to streamline efficiency and strengthen the impact of your cause or campaign. For more information on how James Communications can help you do what you do, please visit www.jamescommunications.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan, CindySheehanSoapbox.com. This is the time of the show when I give you my soapbox rant. I hadn't even fully disembarked from the car today at the gathering point for our march to George Bush's new house to advocate for accountability when about 24 reporters descended on me and started asking me questions. Reporter 1, why are you here? George Bush is not in office anymore. Reporter 2, what do you expect to achieve from this protest? Reporter 3, do you really think George Bush will be held accountable? And this is from a Bush lover behind the reporters. Waterboard her, waterboard her. And then a snotty female reporter kept on asking me, there are more media here than protesters, which was not true. Are you disappointed? It was good that the media was there in such force this afternoon because we really do want our message to get out. And the coverage that I was able to see was pretty good. It was mostly fair and balanced. I was, however, a little irritated because I didn't have this much media coverage when I was a congressional candidate in California running against Nancy Pelosi for the entire year put together. I have often wondered why there was a near-total media blackout during my campaign. We ran a very committed and serious campaign with high energy, and we couldn't get coverage to save our lives. Now I've been out on a book tour promoting my new ebook, Miss America, and the local coverage of my events has been good, but the coverage at the protests in Dallas was overwhelming. I'm taking my message of community building and removing ourselves from robber class systems all over America this summer, and when the Dallas peace community, they decided to welcome George to Dallas with a protest highlighting the lack of accountability for what we consider his high crimes and misdemeanors and crimes against humanity. Another aspect of the protest was that while we were upset that those crimes happened under Bush Co., we are still upset that they are happening under Obama. I don't believe that this nation can heal or move forward without the investigation and prosecution of Bush Co. It's obvious that Obama is not prosecuting George at all because he is pretty much sticking to the same path that Bush did, a path that leads to ruin for the world and power with profit for the few. The right doesn't like our protests because they never did. The left doesn't like our protests because their anointed one is following in the footsteps of murderers, torturers, and liars. Why did I get so much press at Camp Casey and a fair amount after than none while I was running against Pelosi? I've been one of Obama's earliest and most ardent critics, but no one knows that except you who read what I write or listen to Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. Where is the press when we're in front of the Federal Reserve calling for its closure or marching on the 6th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, which is now Obama's war? Why didn't the media cover a long campaign that had the potential for viability but did cover a small march in Dallas? It makes me wonder, but I don't have any answers for the reporters' questions, though. Number one, Bush is not in office, but neither should he be living a quiet life in the burbs. He should be on a chain gang serving time for all of his crimes. Number two, we expected to be able to educate and enlighten. We didn't expect George Bush to come out of his home and turn himself into the Dallas PD. But we also don't feel that his crime should be covered up and allowed to fester in the psyche of our history. Number three, no, I don't really think that anybody in Congress or the Justice Department will have the guts to stand up to their anointed one in the Oval Office and demand a special prosecutor to at least investigate the Bush regime. I don't have high hopes that justice for the death, torture, and displacement of so many will ever be seen. But that doesn't mean that we should give up. If we at least don't try, failure is guaranteed. I barely got out of the car before the snotty female reporter was badgering me that there were not too many protesters there. We didn't have permits, and we had to be very careful to stay on sidewalks and public spaces. Secondly, we had about 100 people there. The pro-Bush people, there were about 12. And I think that's pretty darn good for a Monday at 4:30 in this economy that the new resident of Prescott Hollow in Dallas destroyed. Finally, I wasn't disappointed in the protest at all. I was very pleased with the energy and the courage of everyone who came out to a very conservative neighborhood to protest a person who, at least in that neighborhood, who is inconceivably popular still. There's really no anti-war movement at the moment. Local action should not be discouraged, but encouraged. Any action for peace and justice, small or large, is valid and should be supported physically, monetarily, or in spirit by the entire community. Okay, my Ask Cindy questions today are really just from two people who had completely different views of our protest at George Bush's ranch. The first one comes from, I'm sorry, we didn't go to George Bush's ranch. I'm stuck in a time loop here. Yeah. We went to George Bush's new home in Preston Hollow, a suburb, a very wealthy suburb of Dallas. My first email was representative of the people who were disappointed in me or hate me or didn't want me to be there. The one that I can read that didn't have any horribly sexist swear words or anything like that is from someone named Randy Herschelman, who lives in Dallas, Texas, and he said, "Dear Cindy, you are a disgrace to America. Get off the air and stay out of my hometown, Dallas. I have had more tragedy in my life than you can imagine. There is no excuse for you and your kind." And then he put about 15 exclamation points after that, so he was really upset about our protest. But our second one comes from someone named Tim, who is actually in the Navy. He's a naval CB, and he says, "Dear Cindy, I recently saw a video of you in Texas near the new home of former President Bush. In that video, there was a man criticizing your efforts. I feel that your son died supporting and defending the Constitution of the United States, which guarantees the First Amendment right to free speech. Though he died needlessly, because of the bad decisions of our former leaders, we all swore an oath to support and defend. Your son made the ultimate sacrifice, and your right to speak your opinions about the tyranny of the former president are paramount. Thousands of people have died needlessly in the global war on terror, and thousands more are losing their rights. I applaud your actions and respect your right to free speech. I wish I had the courage and devotion that you have demonstrated in your anti-war efforts. I have heard so many people talk about how Cheney and Bush, quote, kept us safe, unquote. That's bull blank. Because 9/11 happened on their watch and the forfeiture of the Constitution was their doing. Never quit. I hope you run for office again. In the military, people are trained to be flexible. Higher level people are trained to be fluid and adaptable to the changing situation environment. Best regards, Tim." So those were two completely opposing positions about our protest in front of George Bush's Texas ranch. Well, that's it for Cindy Sheehan's soapbox, except your soapbox action is to check out the Muslim Legal Defense Fund. And if you can, give them $5 or $10, because while we are defending their rights, we're also defending ours. I'd like to thank you for listening. Please spread the word about Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. I'd like to thank Scott, my engineer, Rich, my webmaster, and my guest today, Khalil Meek. Join us again next week.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know. The air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.